Good afternoon. This is Division 4 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. We're welcoming today Judge Leonard Plank, senior judge, sitting with us. We have on the docket two cases, case 09CA-492, People Against Hakel. Is it Hakel?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. And 09CA-2193, or counsel here for 2193. Thank you. Have you all received the written instructions regarding oral argument?
Yes, sir.
Are there any questions from any of you? All right, each side will have 15 minutes. The appellant can reserve whatever time you want. Just check the clock and you can reserve what time is remaining. We'll now hear People Against Hakel.
Please, the court. My name is Sean Harris, registration number 28080. And I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
And when you see the clock clicking down, the yellow light will come on at 5 minutes. And you can save any time.
Thank you. Your Honors, in this case, what is at issue is two main issues. One is one of the sufficiency of the evidence, and the other pertains to whether the trial court erred in imposing a consecutive sentence under these circumstances. There was another issue that I had briefed, and after the Attorney General submitted its answer brief, the case of People versus Montes came out that seemed to have knocked the wind out of the unit of prosecution argument under the statute of possession of a weapon by a previous offender. I've still raised the issue, but I don't intend to argue that. I think that's, at this point, a futile effort. With respect to, if I could...
At the same time, to understand, you're not confessing that issue, you're just not going to argue it.
I'm not confessing the issue. I don't want to abandon that issue.
Okay.
With respect to the first issue that I'd like to address to the court, deals with the idea of whether or not Mr. Hakel's act of possessing the firearm, I'm jumping to the second argument first, constitutes a single act supported by the same evidence, or, as the people suggest, these are in fact separate acts, and therefore the trial court was correct in imposing consecutive sentencing. I submit to this court that under the case of Jewell versus People, that was cited in the brief, that we abandon a strict analysis of whether there was different evidence required to prove up each of these counts. And then instead, we look to whether Mr. Hakel engaged in a single act of possessing all weapons at the same time. And the analysis under Jewell appears to be directly applicable to this case, where in that instance, Mr. Jewell was accused of vehicular homicide and a first-degree assault. And although the prosecutor in the case looked at different evidence to support each of the charges, that in the end, the court indicated that the act of driving in the manner that he did was no different, whether we talk about one count versus another. And that's really the same in this case, insofar as even if there was sufficient evidence to conclude that Mr. Hakel possessed these firearms, what in his conduct each time he entered the bedroom made him possess one weapon more so than another, or possess one weapon not at all versus possessing a weapon that may have been resting in the corner of the bedroom, as the people seem to argue in the alternative in their reply brief. Quite frankly, I can't see anything in the record that would differentiate Mr. Hakel's conduct, how he went about visiting his wife at that residence, that makes a difference, a legal difference, in whether he possessed one or all of the weapons which ultimately led to his conviction. So in applying the Jewell standard then, it appears that Mr. Haeckel engaged in the act of entering the room, thereby possessing all the weapons or none of the weapons. And by doing that, the trial court erred in looking at each weapon as different evidence to justify the imposition of a consecutive sentence.
Is the entry into the house, the physical presence, is that the act of possession, or is it simply indirect evidence that he was the owner of these? In other words, could it have been that he was in possession of them, had access to them, but never entered the house?
Well, I think it sort of dovetails into the first argument of whether there's even sufficient evidence to say that he is possessing the firearms. And I think more is required than simply ownership. Ownership in and of itself is not sufficient.
Control?
Actual and physical control, I think, is the standard, and so control would be sufficient. But in this instance, going through the scenario, Mr. Haeckel enters the home. At that point, is he more or less in possession of the weapons than he was before he entered the home? He sits at the dinner table. I think the evidence is fairly clear that every night or so he had supper at that residence. And about once a month or so, he slept over. Going to the dining room, does that put him in closer proximity to the weapons? And I think in the end, all these nuances, variations in the facts, can't make that much of a difference. I think it's a matter, because otherwise, a convicted felon entering a Walmart that has a sporting goods section, by the act of entering the Walmart, may well be in possession of a firearm. And so more has to be required.
Excuse me for interrupting, counsel, but his wife's testimony was that he owned the weapons. No one else in the house could use them. And they were in his, quote, possession in that regard.
Well, I think the record indicated that the officer asked, does Mr. Haeckel have any weapons? And the wife said, yes. And so from that, an inference of ownership comes about. I think it's one factor to look to, but the inability of wife and stepfather to be able to use the weapons or not, I think is not important. It shouldn't be important legally. Their inability to use the firearms does not make it more likely that Mr. Haeckel possessed them. It may be that no one at any one given time was exercising control over them. There's certainly no evidence that Mr. Haeckel took any active steps in exercising control over these weapons, never cleaned them, never took them out, handled them whatsoever. Just to clarify, perhaps if necessary, there were three sets of weapons involved.
Right.
Seven were found
under the bed.
Seven were found under the bed.
Yeah.
Two were in a corner that were apparently in plain view, if we can use that term in this context, and Officer Dixon noticed them upon entry of the room. And then there were, I think, about six weapons in the red bag by the headboard of the bed. And for those weapons, Mr. Haeckel was acquitted. Is there a difference in possessing the weapons with respect to the ones that are under the bed or against the wall in the corner in plain view? And I think we can conclude that from the record. It doesn't appear that there's any evidence, especially with the ones under the bed, where there's any evidence showing an awareness by Mr. Haeckel that these weapons were even there. And so really all we have is a case where there are some weapons, seven under the bed, two up against the wall, where Mr. Haeckel from time to time enters the room to sleep, and I think the record is clear that the only purpose he went in there was to sleep about once a month, that proximity alone really gives rise to possession of a firearm. And it appears that more is required, because if not, it gives rise to all sorts of scenarios where a convicted felon getting arrested by an officer is in such close proximity to the holstered weapon that the officer is carrying to be said to be in possession.
Well, is that really so? I mean, here what we have is some evidence of ownership, which would also then imply a right to control. As I understand your argument, the ownership and the right of control would not be sufficient to be in possession. But the next step here that you seem to be arguing is the physical proximity, which gives the ability to control. Does that constitute possession? So I can't see the rationale of your police officer apprehension thing, because there's no right or a right to control. And in the Walmart situation, there's no right to control.
But is there an ability to control? And here again, looking at the record as a whole, it appeared that the prosecutor in this case wanted to draw some inference from two gentlemen going over to the residence to supposedly retrieve the weapons. And the testimony was, wife refused access. She said, you're not getting him.
Let me go back, though, because my question is more directed to what you just said about the police officer and this notion of possession. Is possession, how does that relate to control, and how does that relate to the facts here, to the evidence here?
Well, possession is exercising actual and physical control over the weapon. And so then the real inquiry is there any evidence to indicate that Mr. Haeckel exercised any actual and physical control over these firearms, aside from his mere proximity? And I could submit to the court that there is no evidence to indicate that he was exercising actual or physical control over the firearms.
Wasn't there a list that was found with the firearms that was stipulated to have been written in Mr. Haeckel's handwriting?
I can't address whether it was a stipulation. I just don't recall. But the list, it was a handwritten list that was actually found in the red bag where the weapons were found, for which Mr. Haeckel was acquitted. And I think an inference to be drawn from that evidence is that the jury looked at that list and rejected its significance, because if it hadn't, Mr. Haeckel would have stood convicted of those weapons as well, the ones that were in the bag. But more to the point about the list is that there's no evidence showing when it was written, whether it was before 1990 when Mr. Haeckel was convicted of the predicate felony in this case. So even if he had written the list, and I just don't recall at this point, there's still a causal gap between when the list was written. Was it done after his conviction? Because that would be important, because that would seem to indicate that at least he was taking inventory of these weapons. And I don't think that evidence is really helpful to the prosecution at all.
You have just under 3 minutes.
Yes. I better reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal, if I may. Thank you.
Dale, if Mr. Parrish resumes, let's just give him 3 minutes.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Jennifer Berman, registration number 35882, and I represent the people in this matter. I would first like to, in response to your question, Judge Hawthorne, I would like to point out that it was not stipulated in the record that the handwritten note was in the defendant's handwriting. However, one witness, Detective Dixon, testified that he believed it was, after having viewed, I think, approximately 15 pages of the defendant's own handwriting. The defendant's wife testified. She either testified that it wasn't or that she was not sure. I think she testified that it wasn't. So that was a disputed fact at trial. I'm going to start talking about the consecutive sentencing issue. The defendant, in relying on Jewel, or defense counsel, appears to argue that the statute 18-1408-3 and prior case law, for example, People v. Muckle, somehow do not apply anymore because he implies that the only issue to consider is whether the sentences are based on different acts. So whether there is one act versus more than one act. But really what the statute says is that you look at whether the evidence derives from one act or series of acts, and whether it's identical. Now here the evidence is not identical to support each and every conviction, because each conviction was based on a separate and distinct firearm. That's how it was charged, that's how the jury was instructed, and therefore that's what the verdict form showed, was that each sentence or each conviction pertained to a separate and distinct firearm. From that, you have not identical evidence, and that opens it up to consecutive sentencing. It was within the trial court's discretion to do so. Jewell doesn't change that analysis. Jewell simply clarifies that, I guess Jewell provides that when you look at the evidence, it's not so much could you parse out the evidence so that some goes to one offense, some goes to another. You look at how it was actually presented to the jury and whether or not identical evidence was relied upon in proving the offenses. And here it wasn't identical evidence that was relied upon, because each conviction pertained to a separate and distinct firearm. If the court has no questions on that issue, I'll move on to sufficiency. I'd first like to point out that the definition of possession is not the actual and physical control of the firearm. Rather, it's the actual or physical control of the firearm. And here the evidence was substantial and sufficient to show that to demonstrate that the defendant exercised actual control over the firearm. First of all, he was the owner of the firearm. That was undisputed at trial. Or owner of the firearms, excuse me. In addition to that, you can look at four factors that are set out in the Garcia case to determine if a defendant possesses the firearms in question. You can look at the defendant's proximity to the firearms. And here, there was evidence that the defendant was in the house where the firearms were placed every night for dinner, that he at least slept in the bedroom where the firearms were placed about once a month. And so there is evidence of the defendant's proximity to the firearms. Secondly, you can look at the location in which the firearms are stored. Here they were stored in a bedroom. Two of them were clearly within sight of anyone who walked into the bedroom because they were propped up against a wall. Seven others were possibly within plain sight in that they were stored underneath the bed. Third, you can look at the defendant's awareness of the placement of the firearms. And I believe this is where the parties disagree on the evidence. I believe the evidence is substantial and sufficient to show that the defendant was aware of the firearms placement, in part because of his proximity to them. But also you have evidence of the handwritten note that was in his handwriting, according to some of the evidence, or according to some of the testimony. It's not for this court to reconcile any inconsistencies in the testimony as to whether he, in fact, wrote that note. But that note listed each and every firearm except for one, and an estimated price for each. That note was found in the bedroom. Yes, it was found in a red bag that happened to contain firearms for which the jury determined the defendant did not possess, or at least the jury determined that he was not guilty of the offense for those seven. But that doesn't mean that this court should dismiss that evidence, because the issue isn't for you to determine what the jury this specific jury, in fact, did with the evidence, but rather to look at all of the evidence presented to the jury and to determine what a reasonable juror could do with the evidence. Here, a reasonable juror could have found that the defendant possessed the handwritten note and that the handwritten note clearly showed the defendant's awareness of the firearms.
All of the firearms or only the ones in the red container?
The note pertained to all of the firearms except for one. There was only one that wasn't listed, and I cannot recall from the record if it was one of the nine for which he was convicted or one of the seven for which he was acquitted. Finally, this court can look to the evidence of John Carroll's testimony, in which he stated he accompanied another gentleman, Blaine Elifitz, to the defendant's wife's home to pick up and sell the firearms, I believe is how he put it. And I think that that evidence raises a reasonable inference that Mr. Carroll and Mr. Elifitz were acting on the owner's behalf, and that therefore the owner, the defendant, was exercising control of the firearms by trying to sell them.
There was direct testimony that Mr. Carroll was there at the behest of the defendant?
There was not. I don't believe so. But my argument is that there's a reasonable inference that in stating he went there to pick them up and to sell them, he was acting on behalf of the owner, because that is something that only the owner could do, is to sell the firearms. And finally, the last factor that this court can look at is whether the firearms were locked up or if there are any other impediments that precluded the defendant from having ready access to the firearms, and there were not. The evidence showed that two of them were propped up against a wall. The others that were underneath the bed, some were in holsters, but none were locked up. So from that, there's substantial and sufficient evidence that the defendant possessed the nine firearms and that therefore he's guilty of the offenses. If there are no more questions, I would ask that this court affirm the convictions and the sentences.
Thank you. Mr. Parris is arguing, as best as I understand it, that the possession was a single act. That is, apart from saying that he was in the house many times, apart from saying that he was in the bedroom more than once, that the government is relying on the fact of his physical proximity, that you have convicted him based on a single act. He went into the bedroom, and upon going into the bedroom, now he was guilty of possession. That's just one act. How can he have multiple convictions multiple sentences for that act? He's citing Jewel in the statute with regard to identical evidence. Basically,
okay.
How do you address that?
Well, first of all, the act is not entering the bedroom where the firearms are located. The act is knowingly possessing the firearms, possession being the actual or physical control of the firearms. And here, each one is based on distinct and separate evidence, because each one is based on a distinct and separate firearm. Proof that he knowingly possessed one rifle cannot prove that he knowingly possessed a shotgun. Simply because they were found in the same bedroom, the one is not proof of the other, and therefore under Jewel, you don't have it that they have to be logically based on the same evidence. They can be separated in terms of what evidence supports each conviction. And therefore, it was appropriate for the trial court to impose consecutive sentencing. It was within its discretion.
I think he's arguing that Jewel says that the mere possibility that it's based on other evidence is not sufficient.
If you look at the case People versus Muckle, it specifically says the mere possibility that the jury relied on identical evidence is not sufficient to overcome the trial court's discretion to choose between consecutive or concurrent sentencing. There's nothing in the language of Jewel that overrules that. Jewel simply states that in that case, where you have first degree assault and vehicular assault that were both caused by the defendant driving too fast into an intersection and hitting the victim's truck, that in that case, they are based on identical evidence. As the trial court there found, they cannot be logically separated, and therefore, to that specific case, concurrent sentencing was mandated. Thank you.
If I may pick up on that last point, there is no evidence in the record that differentiates Mr. Hakel possessing one firearm over another. I think Ms. Berman has, she stated, that proof of possession of one weapon is not necessarily proof of possession of another weapon, and I agree with that. But we don't have any differentiation in the facts in the record that show that Mr. Hakel possessed one weapon because he went hunting with it, and that becomes the proof for possession or establishing possession on, with respect to that weapon. Whatever the record is, whatever the facts of possession are, they were applied equally with respect to all of the firearms. And so therefore, the record focuses on one act that's the same for all weapons. And that falls under Jewell as focusing on the act, you find possession of multiple weapons, that one act is no different from one to another, and therefore concurrent sentencing is appropriate in this case.
So if a is it would it be your argument that if he was walking down the street and he had two weapons and was stopped and they decided that he was a felon and couldn't be in possession, then that moment, that act of walking down the street with two weapons, they would have to, it would have to be concurrent sentences?
If that's the only evidence, then I would say yes. But if there's evidence that the one weapon the person used in a bank robbery and the other weapon the person used shooting skeet, I think you call it, then there's separate evidence justifying separate acts. And in that case, if all the other checks of the trial are observed, making sure that the time periods are specified and so on, then I think that in that instance, that gives rise to a possibility of consecutive sentencing. But if all you have is someone without more, and there may well be other facts, but not other evidence, that shows someone carrying two weapons in a sack, I think Jewell is clear that we look at the act of possessing. It's the same for both, therefore concurrent sentencing.
We could have separate charges because we would have a possession of the handgun, a possession of the rifle. Correct.
Right. Now that the unit of prosecution issue is no longer an issue, so to speak, I think that's correct.
Or so it would seem.
Without abandoning that issue.
Right.
That argument.
But assuming that is to be so, but your argument would be you might be able to get two separate convictions based on the identity of the two separate weapons, but the possession happened at one time in a single act, and therefore must be concurrent.
I see my time has expired, but if I could just answer that question.
Yeah.
I think it depends on what evidence comes in, and even though you have someone at one time carrying two weapons, if there's still other evidence that comes in showing the person in possession of those two firearms at different times, then I think we're back into consecutive sentencing range. Yeah, consecutive sentencing range.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Excellent arguments from both of you. We appreciate that. The case is now submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.